Hey, everybody, it's Kat, and I want to welcome you to this episode of Backstory Sessions. I'm joined today by my co-host, Matt. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Kat. Hey, everyone. How are you?
Well, we've reached a milestone. This is the first guest that we have had on for 4 times on the podcast.
That's true. Yeah, he is returning for, yeah. I'm trying to remember when the first one was. It's been a while, though.
Yeah, probably like 3 years or something, I would say.
Yeah, we're doing like a travel episode or something.
Yeah, it was him and another lady. So it was a split episode of that time. So you could say that was like half a guest, you know, if you want half an episode. But they did about travel. And then we had Pickleball, if you remember the book.
Yeah, so I do remember that, yeah.
A mystery, wasn't it? Or murder, Pickleball?
Yeah, a Pickleball murder or something like that.
Yeah, so definitely that was a hit. And, you know, then it was the Wisdom book.
Ah, yes, I was in that one. Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
You were. I was not, so... But I still remember it, and it was interesting, you know, to talk about the wisdoms and the one that you submitted. And now, you know, he's got a new book out, and we're going to be talking about that. So I feel like he deserves something. So
something like what?
I don't know, a star on his picture that was published or something. I mean,
there you go. Yeah, a star on the podcast Wall of Fame.
That's right. And that's better than the Wall of Shame because
that's true.
And we don't really have one of those, but.
And we don't have the Wall of Fame either, so.
Well, we do now. Jeff Razzle.
Right. We have the theoretical Wall of Fame for
podcasts. Thanks to Jeff Razzle.
Yeah. See that? Well, he's inspired us yet again.
Well, really, it's thanks to me thinking of it, but I don't know. You think that'll get me in the book?
maybe the next one. You never know.
Yeah, I hope there'll be a next one because, you know, it would suck to be, like, cut up right now when I'm, you know, I've earned a spot.
Yeah, well, I mean, he writes quite a bit, as I recall, so, you know, you never know.
Well, this one is it sounds very interesting. You know, it's a hitchhiking story based a bit, it seems like, on his own true experiences, which, you know, I think all writing probably has little bits and pieces of the writer's life or true experiences mixed in, don't you think?
Yeah, usually. Some aspect of it, you know, like something that happened to you or somebody you know or some story that you've heard of or whatever.
Yeah. So, you know, I personally would be afraid to hitchhike. I also don't want to pick up any hitchhikers. But sometimes, you know, like my heart feels like bad about that. It'll be like... But, you know, like,
yeah.
their cars broke down or, you know, whatever. But I don't know. I mean, I'm just, if I don't know the people, I will stop, like, you know, and call if they need somebody called.
Right.
But, you know, I'm just too afraid.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't really done too much hitchhiking. I have done it years ago, not recently. But, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you see those people at the interstate exits or whatever, you know, that are like, will work for food, need, you know, whatever. But that's like, you know, I don't know if they're really hitchhikers, but I don't stop and pick them up either.
Yeah. So, I mean, if somebody's going from like, I don't know, in your case, let's say they're going from Corbin to Lexington or something like that. I mean, maybe I would give them a ride. I don't know. Because I'm going that way anyway. So,
you know, for me, it would be a pass unless I knew them because, they get, you know, you get on that Interstate 75 going north and you're as good as trafficked right into, you know, wherever they traffic you.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, really, there's just so much stuff going on in the world that it's just hard to know.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you gotta be, you know, I guess you gotta be smart about it.
Yeah. And, you know, without a doubt, like if I saw somebody that was a former student or, you know, someone even in the community that I recognized as, you know, a friend of a friend, something, you know, I mean, I definitely like to help people. But you have to, you know, like it's, you can't kill yourself to do that. So,
yeah.
So, but I mean, I do find like the hitchhiking aspect of things, it's kind of like the, I guess what Jeff Rasley is kind of like, you know, he like travels and does all these expeditions and things like that. So, and people that do nomadic life, I mean, all of it sounds very interesting and intriguing, but I'm just too much of a scaredy cat.
Well, I mean, you know, I guess this story takes place in the early 70s from what I remember. And, you know, things were a little bit different then where,
yes. And also, I was a lot younger and did not see things like I do see them now. So, you know, I did a lot of things that my parents were like so worried, you know, like, oh my gosh, you're going to get killed or, you know, whatever. Like, you can't do that. And I never, like, I mean, I went to Texas with my friend Mary, so it wasn't just me. But I mean, we'd never driven to Texas. And at that time, you know, there were maps like atlases, you know, so you didn't have GPS or cell phones or anything like that. And, you know, we just got the map. She got off from work. I was already off from work. We headed to Texas, made it to Texas, stayed with this family that we knew nothing about. Absolutely nothing. And they were the nicest family. Like, you know, they like had fresh squeezed orange juice every morning. Like, you know, they were so good to us. I was like, oh, you know, I want to stay here for a while. But, you know, the guy didn't end up being like all that interesting, but the family, I would love to have the family. But anyway, you know, I mean, didn't think a thing about that. And, you know, I probably wouldn't do same thing now.
So. Naivete. Naivete of youth, yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe it was foolish. I don't know. But, I mean, that's part of being young, isn't it? Like, young and foolish, I think.
I guess that's part of it. But, you know, I mean, I'm sure you remember my trip to Ukraine. I mean, some would call that foolish. And I did that, like, you know, when I was in my 50s. So
I was going to say, you can't really claim the young part.
Right. Exactly. Younger.
But younger, right. Yeah. So I
don't know if it's like something that, I guess you lose your, you know, that spirit over time to some degree. I mean, some people do. Others, you know, they're just more or less fearless.
Well, I mean, like, I think like children, even, you know, if you watch children, you know that they don't think about fear and all those things. Like, they're just thinking about what they want or, you know, what they're wanting to try. And
right, yeah.
So I do think, like, it's a good thing that you get wiser as you get older, because you wouldn't last that long in most cases if you didn't learn, you know, that fear is, I mean, there are some things that are not safe to do. So
are you saying that hitchhiking is not safe to do?
I mean, it's definitely is a risk, just like going on that trip to Texas. Like, you know, Ted Bundy, like, he could be the one picked you up, you know, I mean,
yeah,
if you,
yeah, that's true. I guess, you know, there's all sorts of risk in life, so you just never know.
Right. And you can't always tell, you know, by looking either, because again, like the serial killers, like Ted Bundy, you know, attractive and, you know, lawyer and, or passing off to be a lawyer. I don't know if he really was one, whatever, but, you know, good looking guy and whatever, did not look the type of what people thought was going to be somebody to kill them. So, I mean, you know, you never know, but then you've got other people, you know, that you, I mean, so you could be married to someone for many years and then find out that they're also crazy as could be and kill you. Because that happens too, you know, that.
Sure. I think we're, you know, kind of getting off track though. It's like, you know.
Well, I mean, I think it does speak to, yes, I am afraid of hitchhiking and it is risky. You know, in my mind, it is too much of a risk. But as you said, we do take risk all the time. Life is, you know, I mean, every decision really has some risk. And it's just a matter of the balance, I think, of, you know, how much risk is a reasonable amount for your life. And, you know, hopefully the odds are in your favor.
May the odds be ever in your favor.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you never know.
Right. So. That's a line from the Hunger Games.
Yeah, well, and that is a popular, you know, that was very popular. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, so I guess you're right. I guess it's like all in what you're willing to tolerate and, you know, your risk avoidance and things like that.
Yeah, because really, I mean, you could, if you thought about every risk, every germ, every, you know, every.
Yeah, you'd like, never leave the house.
No, you'd be locked in a bubble. You'd be afraid to eat any foods, take any medicines. You know, you'd be afraid the government, like, you know, surveying your house.
Right, yes. Yeah.
So you wouldn't talk on the phone. I mean, you know, so I think you could just go overboard and be afraid of everything or be afraid of nothing. You know, I think both of those are kind of extremes and they don't work for me. Mm. Not too, you know, but I probably could like loosen up a little bit, you know, on my fears. But overall, I would say age appropriate. I'm pretty age appropriate with fears, I think.
So do you find yourself more fearful now than you were years ago? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I must, because, you know, like I said, I wouldn't take off now to like some stranger's house. And
yeah, and probably not.
But, you know, and now you have, like, cell phones. You have a lot of things that you could maybe, like, you know, I could say, hey, Matt, you know, I'm going to this location. Yeah. You know, if I don't call you at, you know, whatever, you'll send help or whatever. I mean, we didn't have that. Like, that was payphone days, you know, remember? And that's if you had a quarter or
dime,
35 yeah. cents. Or,
yeah. Collect call.
I know. And, you know, my parents, they would have accepted it. But, you know, my dad, he was always like, I don't believe, you know, it's like he didn't believe I was going. He thought I was just saying it to aggravate my mom. Mm-hmm. But my mom knew I was going. And she was, like, you know, just like begging me, you know, I'll do anything if you don't, you know, if you don't go, you're going to get killed. But I did, like, in the days of, again, you had to have a camera, you know, so I did take some photos of Texas, you know, welcome to Texas signs and such. So my dad would know that we actually were there.
Oh, so he was saying that you're just pretending to go?
Yes, just pretending to go. Yeah,
I could see that.
Yeah, it could have been that too. But in this case, I really did go. And, you know, it wasn't just the fact of, like, staying with the strange people. I mean, it was just, like I said, we'd never driven any place like that. You know, I mean, we could have ended up in, I don't know, Maine or something. But luckily, I was a good map reader. So, you know, we did fine there. I did get a speeding ticket. so, you know, that's unfortunate. Killeen, Texas, if you're listening. But,
yeah. I find that a little difficult to believe only because I've driven with you before. So
I know. Yeah. I know. It's like, well, I mean, so in my life, I have gotten 2 speeding tickets.
Wow. Only,
and I slowed down after that.
Huh.
Yes. I mean, well, you know, I was a lot more cautious of where I might be speeding.
Yeah.
After that, because, you know, you don't want to get points on your license and all of that.
So do you speed now?
No.
Okay.
No, you know, and the speed limit has gone up now too, you know, compared to what it was at that time when I got, I don't even know what it was in Texas, but you know, like the roads are, like the miles are really long. And I just had, like, Mary was the one driving and we had just switched. Mm-hmm. So, you know, here I am, like, all fresh, ready to drive and get back home because, you know, every mile seems like 50.
Yep.
And I'm just like, you know, it looks safe. So, again, I'm, you know, assessing the risk. The risk looked like, yeah, this road looks safe for me to go whatever speed I was going.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, except for, you know, I didn't assess the police being, you know, so caring.
Hiding behind the billboard.
Well, you know, they cared about my safety.
And, yes,
And, you know, I mean, it is true that I only did get one more speeding ticket after that. So I feel like, yeah, you know, maybe that did help me along the path.
Yes, potentially so. You know how many I've gotten?
I mean, how many you deserve would be a lot, but I'm going to say you have gotten 4.
I've actually gotten 1, and it was, they dropped it, so I never got charged with it.
Were you speeding?
Yeah. I drove by a state police car at like 80, you know, well, 55.
How come you didn't have to pay it?
Because they got me for DWAI. Which was, I had been at a bar earlier and stopped drinking like 2 hours before I left. And, you know, so they did the breathalyzer and all that. And I was just under the legal limit for drinking. And so whatever the next step down from a DWI is what I got charged with.
Well, you know, listeners out there, you know, don't listen, don't follow along. Learn from us.
Yes, yeah. Well, I mean, that was back in the, you know, like the 80s, so.
Yeah, I mean, would you say, like, you're wiser about that kind of activity now and you're driving?
Drinking and driving, sure. Yeah. Driving faster than I should? Eh, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, you know, so I do think, like, you get a little bit more wise. However, there's probably a point, which we're not at the age yet, but when we get to, it will probably be like, okay, well, you know, we're at about the end here, so let's just, like, throw caution to the wind and do whatever we
want to do. Yeah. Yeah, that could be. We'll see. I mean, not too far away, so.
Well, you know, we're far enough. But another season or two.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of seasons, we have one more episode after this one.
Oh, and season 11 will be history.
Is it 11 or 10?
11. We're on 11 right now.
Oh, okay. Well, see, you're more up on this than I am. But I know we've talked about a couple things for next season, and we got a lot of cool stuff coming up, so.
Yeah, you know, it's going to be exciting for season 12, which we'll see everybody in May for that. And
yep, Cinco de Mayo.
Yeah. So, you know, just lots to look forward to and lots happening between now and then. So,
all right. Well, let's talk to Jeff and find out what his hitchhiking story is and where he went and how that all went for him.
Well, and let's see if we can get me in the next book.
There you go. All right.
Well, Jeff Resley, I am so happy to have you as our guest again on Backstory Sessions. It's been a while.
It has been. And thanks for having me back, Kat and Matt.
Yeah, I do think it's the fourth time. And if it is, you will be our very first fourth time guest.
Okay. Well, that's got to be worth something. I'm looking forward to the check in the mail.
That and yeah. $5 will get you some coffee at Starbucks.
Okay, I'll take it.
Well, this book that you're going to be discussing today is quite interesting. A Hitchhiker's Big Adventure. You know, I myself have never hitchhiked. So we'll just start with that. Matt, I don't know. Have you?
Yeah, I think I have. Certainly not hundreds of miles, but yeah. I do remember catching a ride into town a few times.
Okay. So, you know, you all can share that experience. I would be terrified. So I'm just going to say that, you know, like the thought of strangers. So Jeff, you know, let's start there. Like you're what, 18 years old at the time?
Yeah. And just the two points. One is, I think, Kat, you're right to be afraid of doing that. And one of the points that I make in the book is how things have changed. So this book is set in 1972, and how back then there was this kind of hippie, peace, love zeitgeist that made hitchhiking much safer, because a lot of the people that were hitchhiking and picking up hitchhikers were, you know, kind of hippies, college students, into the alternative consciousness. So there was that safety factor. But I'm sorry, go ahead. I could tell you were going to ask something.
Well, I was going to say, like, you know, at 18, your view of, you know, what's safe is a lot different, at least for me. I would not have thought as much about it at 18 as I do now.
Yeah. For me, I wanted to do it because, as the title indicates, I wanted to have a big adventure, and it was my first big adventure in terms of going off into the world and doing something that had a certain amount of risk and doing it solo, although I was with, you know, different people almost all the time, except when I was standing on the side of the road with my thumb out by myself. But to clarify, the book is half memoir and half, well, probably it's about 80% memoir and 20% fiction. I mean, it's what the literati would call autofiction, which is a fictionalized memoir. Because I didn't want to write just a straight memoir of the experience, because mainly it was so long ago, I can't remember a whole lot of it. And I didn't keep a journal, and I didn't take a camera. So I have no pictures, no journal to jog my memory. And so what I did is I took most the characters in it that picked me up and that I run into were all people that I actually did have encounters with, or they're at least based on those characters. And all the places that I stopped where I, you know, crashed for the night or spent time, those are all places that I actually did that. But some of the events are changed, and some of the people are changed in certain ways. But so anyway, it isn't a straight memoir. It's a novel. So it's, like I said, it would be classified as auto fiction.
And so I did have that as a question to ask about how much of it was, you know, the true experience and then how much of it was a fictional part. So that's very interesting that you've added that. So I don't even have to ask that, but I've got a lot of things I do have to ask. And I, the first thing is like, okay, so I understand like, you know, people wanting adventures and like risk sounds exciting and I guess, you know, and all of that. How did you go about, I mean, so you're in college and then you drop out of college after a semester and then you worked enough to make $65. So is that part true? Did you, is that what you made to, you know, to go off on this adventure? You had $65?
Yeah, that's completely true. I did one semester college, dropped out, worked in a factory, which was probably more dangerous than hitchhiking because I was running this steel cutting machine that had no safety devices. And every other person in the factory that had run that machine lost fingers. But I don't know if I was smarter or more agile than they were. But anyway, I did it for 6 weeks, and back in 1972, I saved up $65 from that, and when I got back home after being on the road for 6 weeks, I had $5 left.
Wow. So was 65, were you, was it a conscious effort to like, okay, I'm going to work until I've got $65, or you know, was it, okay, I've worked as long as I'm going to, and I just happened to be with $65.
Yeah, it was the latter. It was like, I can't stand this any longer. I want to get out of here. And that's, you know, that's how much I had. So,
okay. So you got $65. I imagine you pack lightly, but what do you take with you?
I took clothes, sort of, you know, personal kit, soap, that kind of thing. Probably not deodorant. And because I'm starting out in northern Indiana and it's in the dead of winter, so it's cold and snowing. So I'm, you know, kitted out with warm clothes. But then because my intention is to get down to Key West, I've got, you know, a bathing suit and shorts and that kind of, those kind of clothing. And had a big knife for protection. And that's about it. Oh, I had a flashlight and I had some reading material, some snacks, which were used up fairly quickly. Mm-hmm. And that was about it. And had it all, you know, stuffed in what was a Boy Scouts of America pack, which, I covered the BSA emblem with the dove of peace symbol, and because I wanted to project more an aura of being a hippie than being a Boy Scout. So, and a sleeping bag.
Yeah. Okay, so was it for just a warmer weather that you chose Key West, or what made that the first destination?
It's the furthest point south, and I wanted to go south. And so I'd been to Key West on a family trip when I was a little kid and thought it was pretty cool. So there was, you know, had nice memories of it, but it was mainly just like, that's as far south as you can go. So make that the destination, and that's where I'm headed.
All right. So you're all ready to go, and how long before someone picks you up?
It wasn't very long, and the first ride I got, I have in reality just kind of a vague memory of the guy being, you know, kind of like hippie type on speed, who was sort of scary because he was always talking and looking at me while he was driving instead of paying attention to the road. So his character and our conversations are almost entirely made up because I, you know, just had this very vague memory of him. The next person that picked me up, I have a very clear memory of. So, okay.
And who was that? Like what?
Well, he was a very tall man who looked like he was about 40, and he wanted to engage in sex with me. And
I imagine that would be hard to forget on your second pickup. Okay.
Well, it's especially memorable because growing up in a small town, a very conservative small town in northern Indiana, I had never known someone who was an out-of-the-closet homosexual. And one of the things I wanted to experience that I, you know, thought this would be a big adventure was to encounter people that were different than people I had known in my small town. And so the second person that picks me up was very different because, like I said, at that point in my life, I had never known somebody who was openly gay or a man who wanted to have sex with me. So that was an interesting encounter. And when I managed to get a nice long ride all the way from Indianapolis down to Bloomington, where Indiana University is, which was my goal for the night, and managed to do it without having to have sex with the guy. So,
I mean, so were you naive to what was going on at first, or?
No, in the sense that he came right out and asked, and it didn't take him very long before he did that. And so, but it shocked me. I mean, it was shocking, and it was also scary. And I'm pretty decent size, and at the time, and still, I was very fit. I was a three-sport athlete all through high school, and so I knew how to take care of myself in a fight. And my immediate thought was, oh my God, I'm going to have to fight this guy off, and he's actually bigger than me. But I also developed just almost instantaneously a strategy to avoid any kind of a conflict, which was I started asking him about his life. And I told him, I've never met somebody who's homosexual before. Would you mind telling me, you know, about yourself, and how did you figure out you were gay? And I just, you know, asked him a whole bunch of questions like that. And he seemed to enjoy answering them. And he told me sort of the whole story of his life and why he thought he was homosexual, which he blamed it all on his mom, which back in those days was sort of the classic understanding that you had a domineering mother and you know, not, and kind of an inconsequential father. And he sort of fit that stereotype. But I had taken a psychology class in high school, and also my first semester in college, I'd taken intro psych class too, and sort of remembered that one, either my high school teacher or the college professor had, you know, briefly addressed the subject and had thought or either said that there was evidence that this was your sexual orientation was genetically determined. And so I asked him about that. And, you know, we had an interesting discussion about whether that was possible or it was all environmental. And I mean, he was a thoughtful, intelligent guy, but he did this routinely. He told me he'd go out on the highway, pick up, and because back then there were a lot of young guys out hitchhiking, pick up young guys hitchhiking and see if they wanted to get it on.
Interesting. I mean, was there anyone that you turned down a ride from?
No. Okay, no, I didn't. And I got in like one car, or actually truck. I got in, and the guy has his hand kind of down near his feet. And as I start to get in, I look, and he's got a handgun in his hand. And there's a rifle on a gun rack in the cab of the truck. And so there was a moment of, oh man, maybe I ought to jump back out of here. But he turned out to be a fascinating guy. It was one of the more enjoyable rides I got, which was across Alligator Alley down in Florida from Miami over to Naples. And he was an alligator hunter. So he, and we even, while we were driving across through the Everglades, at one point he stops, pulls over, grabs the rifle, jumps out of the truck and runs out into the mangrove swamp, the Everglades, with his rifle, you know, looking around because he thought he'd seen a gator, but he didn't shoot one. Although he told me it would have been great for my education if he had. So,
so I mean, was there a plan B, like if you had gotten into a situation, did you have a plan B of like, okay, this is enough of this, I'm going to take my $65 and try to get back home?
No, I didn't really, but I knew that if I really got in trouble, I could call my parents or call my girlfriend, and they would probably come get me. And I had a step-grandmother in Inglewood, Florida, which is just maybe 90, I think it's about 90 miles north of Naples, which was why I was going over across Alligator Alley at that point to get to her house. And I spent several days at her house. So she was also sort of a safety valve that I could call on if I needed. But I didn't, you know, this was something I wanted to do. I didn't expect or, you know, really even think through, okay, plan B is, you know, XYZ. It's just, I'm doing this. I got myself into it. I'm going to get myself out of it. And I've always, I mean, years later when I was doing Himalayan expeditions and climbs on peaks, that was always the attitude I had. And I sort of resent people who, like in the mountains, who would get into trouble and have to be rescued because it puts the lives of other people at risk. Rescuing people on big mountains is a dangerous thing to have to do. And I was determined I would never have to call on somebody else to get me out of a situation that I put myself in, knowing that this is risky. And so I've always tried to be, at least in my own mind, prepared to handle whatever came up. And so far, I always have.
Was there anyone that discouraged you from this trip?
Oh, my mom. She actually drove me out to the highway. We actually live close to State Road 15, which was where I started hitchhiking south, but she drove me out to State Road 15 and then down south of town and was kind of weeping as we were driving and as, you know, I got out of the car. So she didn't think this was a great idea. My dad, I think, was not so upset about it because he'd hitchhiked across the country when he got out of the service to get back home from the West Coast.
Was there like a reason that you would have had a lesser adventure, you know, by taking a bus or, you know, some other means?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, riding a bus could be pretty interesting. I've had some interesting bus rides. If, you know, you get to talking to people on the bus. But in terms of the sort of the intimate experience of being in a car, either, I mean, it was usually with just one person, although there were a few rides with more than one person in the car. But, you know, being in this very small space with someone and there isn't anything to do other than listen to the radio or look out the windows than talk. And so I had just, I mean, I sort of entered into other people's lives, and so many of them were people like I would have never met in Goshen, Indiana. And that I wanted to have that experience. I thought that would be really cool. And it was. And I knew there would be some risks. And that's why I had the large knife in the side of my pack, which I usually was within reach. But, you know, to meet people like the guy who picked me up in a Ferrari. And I mean, who drives a Ferrari and will pick up hitchhikers? But this guy, he was Jesus in a Ferrari, because he had decided to try to live like Jesus and would offer help to anybody he met. And so it was really cool to get a ride in this Ferrari. Mm. But I was on my way home at that point, and because he stopped every time we saw. And back then, cars broke down. So every time we saw a car that was broken down, or we saw another hitchhiker, which we couldn't pick up because we couldn't get more than the two of us in the car, he would stop. He would give them money. We went, we got gas for a young couple who'd run out of gas. He paid to get a car fixed at a gas station because this Hispanic family had their car was broken down. And he gave citrus fruit and money. He had it in the trunk, this big box full of grapefruit and orange juice, or oranges, because he'd been down to Florida and was taking this back to Minnesota where he lived. And it ended up taking a hell of a long time to get that very far. So actually that night when we stopped to sleep at a rest stop, I ditched him and found another ride. And so I went from getting a ride with Jesus in a Ferrari to the two guys that I then got a ride with were the mafia from Dowagiac, Michigan. And they turned out to be a real hoot, because their criminal enterprise is, from what I could tell, was mostly in their imagination. Yeah, but they wanted me to join their gang, and so I said, yeah, sure, but after you drop me off, I'll be in touch.
Well, which had the bigger impact, the mafia or the Jesus?
Well, the mafia was more entertaining, except when there was an old guy and a young guy. The young guy drove, and the old guy, who was really decrepit looking, but who was the godfather of the Dowagiac Mafia, when he pulled a revolver out of his glove compartment and spun the cylinder around. And it's like I'd gotten in the car and we'd driven, oh, for maybe 10 minutes or so before he seemed to sort of notice that I was in the back seat. And all of a sudden he declared that there was somebody else in the car. And got this revolver out. And so that was not very edifying, but it turned out to he was really more or less just playing with the gun. But Jesus was really inspirational. And what was the timing was kind of cool, because just a couple days before that, I had spent the night in a church. I slept on the porch of an Episcopal church, and then in the morning, the priest found me there and took me in, and I spent the morning rapping. Back in those days, rapping meant talking, conversation, so using the 72 lingo, but so had this really, you know, in-depth kind of spiritual talk with this priest. It gave me tea and donuts while we talked, and about what did it mean to be a Christian? Was I a Christian? And at that point, I said, you know, I was brought up Christian, believe in the principles, especially the, you know, love your neighbor as yourself. Try to follow that in my own flawed way. But no, I don't believe in the virgin birth and the resurrection and the kind of the crazy myths that Christianity and every other major religion try to foist off on their believers. So then to meet somebody who was as true and authentic as anybody I've ever encountered, was trying to live the way of Christ and being, you know, self-sacrificial in every opportunity, was like, oh, wow. I mean, I am so far away from the principle that I had just told this priest that I did believe in and wanted to follow. It was a great experience to then, you know, kind of have this test and to have him sort of in the back of my mind the rest of my life. So instead of, like, you know, remember the phrase, what would Jesus do? When I ask that, I'm picturing a guy in a Ferrari, not a guy on a cross.
Yeah. Did anyone have, like, music that just drove you crazy and you just didn't know if you could, like, ride with him too much longer?
No, most of the music was great because a lot of the people that picked me up were hippies and were kind of into the same music I was. And the best music, and to this day, some of the best music I ever heard, I got picked up in Alabama by a black guy. And it was the only African American of all the many rides I got. And of the hitchhiking I'd done before and after this, it's the only time an African American ever picked me up. And so we're driving through Alabama and Mississippi, and we're in a Cadillac. So it had, for the time, a really good radio. But and I don't know if this is still true, but back then there were all these local stations that, and many of them were African-American owned, that played sort of local rock or music by local rock, soul, blues, jazz musicians. And he knew all the stations. So, you know, we'd go 20, 30 miles and he'd have to change the station because the range of these stations was so limited. And I mean, the music was, and gospel, I mean, it was so much better than the sort of pop rock stuff that me and my hippie friends listened to.
So how long did the trip take from the time you left home to you got to Key West? Let's just go to there now.
It took me a little over a week to get there, and I would have gotten there sooner, but so I spent two nights at Indiana University with friends, and then I spent a day and a half at Hanover College with friends. And so I, you know, kind of added time, at least another day and a half that it took. But you know, if I would have just hitchhiked straight there and just sleeping at night wherever I might be at that night, I probably would have been there in 4 or 5 days.
Any females pick you up, or were they not driving, or?
I was picked up by one young woman, and I mean, I think most women, even hippie chicks at the time, would be reluctant to pick up hitchhikers. But I got picked up by a really pretty young woman who was a couple of years older than me outside of Atlanta. And she was going down to Florida to college down there to be involved in some kind of peace, anti-war activist conference. And I couldn't remember all the details, so I made up a whole, you know, kind of added to her character and what she was doing and why she was doing it. So I had her be in the SDS, and she was this, you know, kind of leftist radical committed person, which she was. I just couldn't remember the details to it. But she was delightful. She was just this really happy, buoyant personality, which was really kind of unlike the serious Marxist leftist student radicals that I had known and knew later at the time, because they were mostly really serious and dour personalities. And she was this happy-go-lucky kind of, you know, flower child type, but she was a serious student radical. And she said the reason that she felt safe picking me up is at the time I had on a red t-shirt, which meant I might have been a communist, which I wasn't, but okay. And I had long hair. So she said, I figured you're either a communist or a hippie. Either one would be safe. So she used those two categories as to who she thought she could safely pick up. And she had done a fair amount of hitchhiking herself.
Interesting. All right, Matt, I guess you can take it from here.
Well, so I'm curious. You said you had been to Key West when you were younger, and the trip was just to go back there, and because it was the farthest point south. What did you do when you got there? I mean, did you just hang out for a couple of days? And
yeah, it turned out to be a very strange experience when I was just south of Miami, like right to entering the Keys. I hooked up with two other guys. And one of them was from Key West, and he had been discharged from the Army, had been in very serious combat. He was in a rifle company in Vietnam. And his mom owned a restaurant in Key West, and she had a shrimp boat. And it was a seafood restaurant. And one of the ideas I had was to, when I got to Key West, especially if I thought I needed money, was to see if I could get a job on a shrimp boat or a fishing boat, because I'd heard that, you know, people that own those boats or captains were often looking for people to work for them. So that's sort of a dream I had, mm-hmm. or an idea. And so I get to, these two guys are standing on the road right where I was going to hitchhike, and I stop and talk to them. And, you know, first I'm thinking, well, three of us were not going to get picked up, so I'll just go on down the road and you guys get the first ride and I'll get the next. But they said, no, stay with me, because I said that, and I'm just going to call him Bill. Bill, the Vietnam vet, said, he had some military clothes on, said, you know, vets will pick up other vets, mm-hmm. which was true. He said, so we'll get a ride. They said, and they had hitchhiked all the way from California. And so we'll get a ride from a vet, can almost guarantee it, or somebody who knows Bill, because, you know, there will be people going down to Key West who might know him. And mm-hmm. so first ride we got, they were right, was a Korean War veteran, and he picked us up because he saw Bill, and yeah, that guy looks like he's just out of the Army, got the short hair, got camo pants cut off at the knees, combat boots, you know, that kind of thing, and mm-hmm. a Army duffel bag. And the next guy that picked us up, which was the last ride, actually worked for his mom. So, but what made the experience very weird and unfortunate was, turned out Bill was a heroin addict, had got addicted over in and was going cold turkey, and he was also suffering from PTSD, which, you know, wasn't that well known at the time. And so at first this guy, who just seemed like, you know, really happy kind of guy, I mean, he'd dance at the side of the road in his combat boots. By the time we got to Key West, he was trembling, he was having DTs, he was foaming at the mouth. It was terrifying, especially to an 18-year-old who, again, never experienced something like this, although I was a lifeguard, so I knew something about how to deal with people who were distressed. But So anyway, we got to his house. His mom takes us in, and you know, she's, you know, of course, really concerned about her son, and but she, you know, she's kind of, you know, takes care of us for that night and feeds us really well. And Bill basically just kind of passes out. And the guy he was with was not a vet. He was kind of a rough, I would describe him as almost more of a hobo than a hippie, although he had long hair and had been living rough and had just met Bill on the road. And really, as it turned out, didn't really want me as a third wheel, that he was depending on Bill's mom to give him a job in the restaurant. And he, you know, sort of as things developed, saw me as just sort of either interference or distraction, and made it clear he just assumed that I would shove off. But Bill's mom said, you know, stay for a night or two. And I then did not ask her about getting a job because the situation was just too freaky for me. So I spent the one night there, spent the next day walking around Key West, checking out the sights, got to see the buoy, which marks the furthest southern point in the U.S. And you know, at that point, kind of wished I had a camera. You idiot. You could have brought a camera, but, you know, travel light. And who cares? These pictures are all in my mind. That's what's important. But, and then decided I wanted to go for a swim and got to this, you know, this great looking sandy beach, and then noticed there's a bunch of nude guys all running around naked. So more gayness. It's a gay beach. But anyway, I got to swim in the ocean on Key West, and then headed back north, and then I went to New Orleans.
So you were only there 2 days.
That was my next stop.
Wow. I would.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was thinking this whole thing took way longer than, you know, the week or week and a half or whatever it was before you headed out
to
New Orleans.
Well, then I stopped at the University of Miami, and I spent a few days there. Because while I was there, I was just camping out. It was an interesting situation. There are a number of people who were not students who just camped out by this lake on campus, who were just either like me traveling around, or anyway, were just, a lot of them had tents, which I didn't have. But, you know, like there's this little tent hobo hippie community on the campus. But the most interesting thing that happened to me there was I got flirty fished by two very attractive young women. Okay, so what's flirty fishing, right? You ever heard that term?
No.
Well, I learned that term because it turned out they invited me to come with them to their commune. I said, oh my God, this is... Talk about a dream come true. Who needs a shrimp boat? These are two beautiful young women that are taking me home with them to their commune. So, of course, I'm imagining, you know, sex, drugs, rock and roll. And it turned out the commune was the Children of God cult. And flirty fishing was the term I learned through later research, used by the Children of God to do exactly what they did with me, is send out their pretty young women, or other, turn it around, or handsome young guys who would flirt with the fish and then reel them in, take them home to the commune and suck them in to join it. Which point you would give all your material possessions, including a car, if you had one, to the cult. And But you'd live there, they'd take care of you, three meals a day, and you'd either be assigned to working like maintenance or repair. They had this big house and then two like barracks dorms in the back, or you'd go out flirty fishing. And so it was a really interesting experience being there, and very quickly determining I was not going to stay there, and then sneaking out that night. So I actually only spent a day and into the early morning there, but got the sort of full experience of how
imagine that a lot of people got there and couldn't leave. I would think if they took everything from you at some point.
Yeah, like the compound was enclosed with this high wooden fence, and there were all these cars and motorcycles there that were given up by the members of the commune. And there were some very nice cars, and they assigned two friends to look after you while you were there. And one of them that assigned to me was this young guy who was from a wealthy family, and he had a Camaro, which he'd given to the cult. And, he had been there, he'd been there for, I think, about 2 months, but was totally committed to it. And who knows how much he would have ended up giving to him before he got out.
So you mentioned that you mentioned early on that you had a girlfriend at the time. What did she think about this, you going on this trip?
Well, she was in her last year in high school, so she wasn't going to be able to go with me. Not that her parents would have let her anyway, I'm sure. But she is completely left out of the book. She's not even mentioned in the book because I didn't think it was, fair to her. So what she thought of it is really irrelevant to the book, but she was okay with it. And the next year, or I shouldn't say next year, that summer, we actually went to school in England together, and then spent the rest of that summer traveling, hitchhiking part of the time all over Europe.
So what made you, went to New Orleans, I assume you wanted to go to Mardi Gras.
Yeah, I wanted to experience Mardi Gras, which I did in what turned out to be a very intense way. I was there several days. I experienced a police riot where these anarchists that I had met successfully disrupted a parade at night. And their whole purpose, they traveled around the country and would engage in disruptive and vandal activities to stick it to the man. And their ultimate goal was to bring down the government, but they went about it in these sort of very specific little disruptive ways. And so they came to Mardi Gras to disrupt, I don't know if it was more than one parade, but at least the parade the day that I met them that night. And they became kind of like cheerleaders. And so, there are all these drunk people. And so they go out into the street as the parade is approaching, but it's still a ways off, and start, chanting, something like, take back the streets, and, stuff like that. And the streets are for the people. And so a bunch of drunk people and, maybe some leftist, Marxist, anti-government types, or who knows, libertarians, whatever, get out in the street with them. And in New Orleans, you don't mess with Mardi Gras parades, and they knew this. And so cops on horseback came charging in with their batons swinging and rode over, beat the crap out of people while these two guys slunk off without getting hurt. But all the people that they convinced to get out there and try to stop the parade, a bunch of them got beaten seriously by the cops, because then a phalanx of cops on foot followed the cavalry, and then a couple several paddy wagons. They beat people up, threw them in the paddy wagon, and then, you know, moved on. And one guy I had met that day too was a big guy. He was on, you know, I've forgotten whether it was LSU or some, you know, football team, college football player, big lineman guy. He got his skull cracked by a billy club of a cop. And I figured, that's probably the end of his football career. So it was, you know, a very ugly experience. Before that, Mardi Gras was really cool and had a wonderful experience. Got taken in by a Tulane med student who let me stay in his apartment. Had wonderful taste in music, too.
Always a
very
plus.
Expensive stereo. So, you know, that Mardi Gras was this, you know, kind of combination of just, you know, being taken in by this really generous guy who was in medical school and meeting interesting people, seeing parades, which were really cool, but then having this sort of horrifying experience, which...
I mean, did you know that was going to happen beforehand? Like, the two guys that you met, were they telling you, like, yeah, you got to join in, and, you know?
You got to join in. Well, first, they were very vague about what their plans were. And so the big guy, the football guy, and I had met them, and we were hanging out at Jackson Park and just, you know, like throwing frisbees, smoking pot, having a good time. Jackson Park was like this, you know, the kind of the hippie center of Mardi Gras at the time, and the street musicians playing terrific music. And it's like, you know, mini Woodstock. And so then these are the two anarchists, and they had not told, I'll just call him Fred, had not told Fred and me what their plans were. They said, you know, there's this parade. Come on, let's go over to the parade. And it wasn't until we got there that they started kind of talking to each other about what their plan was, how they were going to execute it. And so, no, you know, I had no idea that's what they were up to until it actually, the wheels got set in motion. And I was smart enough that Fred tried to pull me out into the street, but I just thought, you know, this is a bad idea. I mean, I didn't want to stop with the parade. I thought, you know, that's not right. I mean, these parades are really cool, and the people work really hard to put the floats together and these elaborate costumes. And I'd, you know, seen a few parades by then, and it was a really cool experience. So I pulled away from Fred and stayed on the sidewalk and was just an observer.
Yeah, and the police back then were, you know, not so friendly to, I would guess, the hippie culture kind of people. Yeah.
No. I mean, if you've seen the film or the movie based on the 1968 Democratic Convention, the police riot that happened in Chicago, I mean, this was just a mini version.
Well, Kat, what do you think?
Well, I mean, there certainly is a lot of risk and a lot of adventure, and you live to tell about it and write about it. So, as you look back on it to write and incorporate, you know, fiction as well, what did you learn from the experience, maybe now writing the book, that you maybe didn't or had not thought about prior to that?
Yeah, well, on sort of the cultural, sociological level, one of more historical, one of my observations and conclusions is a change in our culture, that the hippie counterculture zeitgeist, although it was very naive in a lot of ways, was also beautiful in a lot of ways, and it created this sense of adventure, but love and peace and community that pretty much is gone. It died. And of course, you know, the hippies then are the baby boomers now. And to see, you know, people, or just imagine, you know, the people who were hippies and into peace and love back then and now vote for Trump, there's been just such a sense of a dramatic change. More scared, less kind and friendly to strangers, at least. You know, think of the attitude towards immigrants, you know, who are strangers. And all these people, you know, welcome me into their cars, some into their homes, and I am just this stranger, I mean, like a migrant. And then people were so kind and loving, and would that happen now? Do people hitchhike now? You know, no, because we're too scared and we're too unkind to strangers to do that. So that's, you know, one sort of, as I see, unfortunate development in our culture, our sort of our attitude towards other people. And then on a personal level, you know, looking back on it, I don't think this was particularly conscious at the time, was that it was an experience that gave me confidence that I could live successfully through situations that were, you know, that were not necessarily predictable, that were not, you know, that didn't just fit into neat channels. And that served me very well over the years. I mean, it served me well as a lawyer. You know, every case I got as a lawyer, I could react, oh, you know, I don't know how to do this, or, oh gosh, I'm not sure we can win. And instead, you know, my attitude was always, okay, I need to understand, what are the facts, what are the issues? Let me get a hold of this. And if I'm taking this case, we're going to win. And that served me well in athletics. I continued when I went back to college. I played football, rugby, swam. I, you know, had that experience of just going out, encountering the world in this very different way. I think imbued in me a sense of confidence that I could handle situations that were maybe beyond the capacity of a lot of people. And so I kind of end the book saying, you know, something like, I learned that there was no place like home, that being away from home made me really appreciate what a wonderful family and community I had grown up in, and how safe and stable it was, and how I came to appreciate that. And also education, that I really wanted to get an academic, formal education. So those were two immediate lessons that I learned, but also that although I wanted to be part of a community and a family, I also would not lead a conventional life, and I haven't.
Interesting. Well, what's next? Have you started another writing project already?
No, I haven't. I have a book that I feel like I should do, and the experience of writing that book was so much fun and enjoyable, of reflecting back and, you know, remembering the experiences, but also having the freedom to add to it and fill in the gaps and make some experiences maybe a little more exciting than how I remember them. The next book should be this motorcycle trip that a friend and I did 2 years later. So the next, or that summer, I went to Europe, but then the summer after that one, we rode motorcycles from northern Indiana all across the country down through Mexico and ended up within 6 hours of losing both of our motorcycles and having to find our way home without our without our wheels. So that's what I, but I just, I'm having trouble getting up the sort of the focus, the determination to do it. So I don't know if I actually will write that book or not, but that's really, that's what's percolating in the back of my mind.
Well, there seems to be always something percolating in the back of your mind. And we've been fortunate enough to get to hear some of the stories. It's always a pleasure to hear about your writing. And I really, this book is on Amazon for those listening. You'll be able to order that. It's already available. And, you know, I can't wait to just sit down and read it. And
well, one thing, Kat, I have to warn you, I don't quote Matt in this book.
Well, you know, I think I have yet to get my quote.
Well, if you would have picked me up when I was driving through, riding, hitchhiking through Appalachia, you'd be in the book.
Yes, when I was 8 years old, I sure would have, because you'd be like, this cute little 8-year-old girl picked me up.
Yeah. Hey, we could have been a team.
We could have been something. I would have had some good music too. So there you go.
I'll bet. Yeah, I'll bet. I wanted to say to you though, Kat, good luck with your next project. I hope that turns out. Fingers crossed for you.
Yes. See, that's better than getting in the book, Matt.
You get mentioned on your own podcast.
As I recall, that chapter didn't show up in the book until the second printing.
It wasn't the chat. It was the table of contents.
Oh, that's right.
You got out of that.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, no. Yeah, you were in there from the beginning, Matt. So.
See, he's never happy. He should have chosen me. I would have been like, oh, I'm in the book.
Well, yeah, and Matt, how many fan letters have you gotten as a result of, you know, being in that almost New York Times bestseller?
Let me look at the, I have a spreadsheet here somewhere. Yeah, it was exactly, I think Kat was the only one who sent me a fan letter.
Oh, no. Yeah. Well.
Even when I'm, like, slighted, I am still, like, very nice and caring and do the right thing.
You are like Jesus in a Ferrari, Kat.
She's like Mary in a van.
Mary in a van.
Yes, just like that. So.
Yeah, Mary in a minivan.
Yeah.
All right. Jeff, thanks for coming by. We really appreciate it. And great stories, you know.
Well, thanks for having me, you guys. And I always enjoy talking with you. And I hope we'll make number 5 in the future.
Thinking we will. So write that motorcycle book. And
that's, you know, right. With Mary in the minivan shows up, we count on being in 5.
Yeah, well, that could at least be a short story that I could write. Right. Yeah, why not?
I'll take it. I'll take a poem, anything, really.
There you go. All right, well, thank you again. We really appreciate your time.
All right, take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.